Michigan, he explained, participates in the Interstate Cross-Check. That's an understatement. Michigan obtained a list of 499,022 Michiganders to purge.
Will the 2020 U.S. election be stolen? If so, by whom?
Keep an eye on Venezuela in these final few weeks of the campaign, and then afterwards, keep a critical perspective and not just believe what the mainstream media is going to say, because it's a very biased narrative.
Venezuela's 2020 assembly elections are coming up, and the U.S. national security state no doubt has them in mind, even though most U.S. citizens are preoccupied with the upcoming U.S. election.
A lot of Congress know what's going on, too, and they don't have, I have to say, hate to say this, they don't have the courage to move against the national security state any more than the administration does.
Twitter and Facebook did their best to censor a New York Post report about Joe Biden's son Hunter's business dealings abroad. Is this Russian disinformation? We'll take a minute to revisit Russiagate. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Radio Network and its affiliate stations across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. It's official. 1,913,369 ballots were cast but never counted in the 2016 presidential race. That's from the U.S. Elections Assistance Commission. What happened in Michigan? And more importantly, what will happen this time around? Here's Greg Palast reading from his book titled How Trump Stole the 2020 Election.
This whole election is being rigged.
It's rigged.
The election is being rigged.
It's totally rigged.
In 2016, Donald Trump won Michigan by 10,704 votes, officially. Here's what you don't know. 75,355 ballots were never counted. That's official, too. Just spoilage, that is, ballots that were, for some technical reason, untallied. But not just anyone's vote spoiled. Most of these vanished votes were cast in Detroit, where only 1 in 10 city residents are white. Motown, not exactly Trumpville. Exit polls showed Clinton won Michigan, and now the pollsters were apologizing for their mistake. I didn't buy it. If you counted those ballots in the dumpsters in Detroit, Clinton would have won. And if this pattern held in the other two states where exit polls reported she won, Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, Clinton should have won the Electoral College. I'm not sure what's wrong with me. The election was over. Hillary and hubby had moved on to lucrative book contracts, six-figure speaking gigs, and their, quote, charity. Trump was triumphant, and the country, too, had moved on. But it bothered me. The 75,355 ballots no one counted in Michigan. The usual outlets for my investigations, like Rolling Stone, weren't bothered either. They had moved on, too. So I borrowed a few bucks from my pension plan, begged my readers for some spare change, and bought a ticket for Detroit. To do this investigation, I needed a break, and I got it. A surprise call from Jill Stein, the Green Party presidential candidate. She offered me a scoop. Stein was ready to raise $9 million for recounts in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan to prove that Trump lost. That is, if you counted all the votes in these states, she could literally overturn Trump's election. I broke the story, she raised the 9 million in days, and the recount began. But recount is the wrong word. In Michigan, the funds were meant for counting those 75,355 ballots that were never counted in the first place. In Michigan, you vote on paper ballots, which you shove into a scanner to get counted. But a funny thing happened in Detroit. 87 machines broke down. They couldn't read the ballots. Once in Detroit, I met with information specialist Carlos Garcia. He told me his precinct scanners were already busted when he arrived at the opening of voting at 7 a.m. It was finally fixed at 9:30 a.m. He stayed and saw that those ballots cast during the morning vote rush, while the machine was broken, were never run through the scanner, never counted. That non-count was repeated throughout the city. It was easy to catch because the number of ballots in the broken machines did not match the total of ballots that machines said they counted. But, ready for this? The Republican Attorney General ruled that if the number of physical ballots did not match the scanner count, those precincts could not be recounted. Now get that? The precincts with the missing count, the ones you'd want to review, were barred from the recount. So whose votes didn't count? The see no evil recount rule meant that 59% of Detroit's precincts could not be reviewed, specifically the ones with broken machines and missing ballot counts. Detroit. Can you guess the color of the uncounted voters? Occupied territories. One effed up machine in a precinct is bad luck. No big deal. But 87 broken machines, 87 machines not counting thousands of ballots, is a very big deal. An electoral crime wave, a stolen election, and they knew it. Republican state officials knew before Election Day that Detroit's scanning machines were already busted, dysfunctional, or not likely to survive the day. Well before November 2016, the Detroit city clerk, Janice Winfrey, pleaded to fund her budget to replace the bad ballot scanners. But there was a problem. Detroit was bankrupt, and every penny spent had to be approved by so-called managers, overlords, appointed by the Republican governor, Rick Snyder. In 2016, Detroit was an occupied territory, as was Flint, Michigan. In Flint, the state-appointed managers cut the budget for the water system and poisoned Flint's kids with lead. The stories of Detroit's scanners and the Flint water supply go together. If you're going to poison someone's children, you better take away their right to vote against the poisoning. The Michigan ballot count was Jim Crowed by bad scanners, and Trump was triumphant. But Jill Stein was going to spoil the celebration. Her recount would pay for an extraordinary machine that could read those uncounted ballots, the human eyeball. But something funny was happening at the government recount centers. Whistleblower. Late November in Michigan sucks. From a Hampton Inn on a truck route north of the city, it was a long slog through dirty slush and wet snow to meet a whistleblower at a roadhouse bar. And a couple of stiff drinks to get her to loosen up to talk without a stutter or fear on camera. Sue told me she faced retribution in her white suburb, even from in-laws who were not happy about her blowing the whistle. Sue, I can't use her last name, is a computer programmer who thought it would be interesting and just a good thing to do to volunteer for the recount operation at the county building. She didn't even have a strong preference in the election. What she experienced disturbed her enormously. She told me, "We saw a lot of ballots that weren't originally counted because those don't scan into the machine. Ballot reviewers were adding previously uncounted ballots to the Clinton column, and Trump operatives were challenging every Clinton vote and every decision for Clinton. They're creating chaos and slowing up the process and making up nonsense rules to disqualify ballots. At the same time, the Democratic Party had brought in observers who refused to take part in the ballot count or even bothered to get in the way of the GOP obstructors." Despite all the obstruction, it was clear that if the count went ahead unimpeded, Trump would lose Michigan. So Trump did the only thing he could do, stop the count. Trump's lawyer sued in state court in Lansing, the capital. Trump's consigliere had a killer argument. No matter how many times you count the votes in Michigan, Jill Stein's Green Party could not win. Under the law, that meant that Stein had no standing for a recount. Only Hillary Clinton could call for a tally of those ballots. Luckily, Clinton's lawyers were in the courtroom. Unluckily, when the judge asked them for Secretary Clinton's agreement for the ballot count, her lawyer said, "We're just here to observe." Hillary's campaign motto, "Just here to observe." So Stein's challenge was finished, but I wasn't.
That was Greg Palast reading from Chapter 16 of his book, How Trump Stole the 2020 Election.
Well, you just heard about how the GOP shoplifted Michigan by not counting the votes. But there's another issue that we must face in 2020. In the last 2 years, 16.7 million voters have been purged, that is, removed from the voter rolls. 16.7 million voters. Millions are going to show up at the polls and find they can't vote. And that's how they hope to steal Michigan and Wisconsin and Georgia. So, black voters matter, and the ACLU asked me to investigate these states. I got my experts to go through the purge lists, the hit lists of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Georgia. And here's what we found. Hundreds of thousands of voters have been wrongly purged. 198,351 wrongly purged in Georgia, 100,000 facing cancellation of their registrations in Wisconsin, and 152,000 removed illegally, wrongly in Michigan by the last GOP administration. For example, among those removed from the voter rolls was Christine Jordan, the 92-year-old cousin of Martin Luther King Jr. She's been voting at the same poll in Atlanta for 50 years, and they tossed her out. I was there, and I filmed it. You should go to Leonardo DiCaprio's Instagram site or to GregPalast.com and see Christine Jordan and her granddaughter in tears. So I issued our report on Georgia, and no surprise, the Republican Secretary of State of Georgia attacked me and the ACLU, calling me Stacey Abrams shill. Hey, there's worse things to be called. But this purge scam, I fear, will steal Georgia. Now, in Wisconsin, the Democrats kicked out Scott Walker in 2018. The new Democratic administration of Wisconsin, pushed by its Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, who's an African-American activist, adopted our position, and they have refused to purge voters. Bravo, Wisconsin! But Michigan? We found their latest purge list contains 152,000 voters wrongly removed. 152,000 voters, almost all are black, Hispanic, Asian American, or students. Now, the Democrats took over Michigan as well, but both the white Democratic Secretary of State and the white Democratic Attorney General have refused to return a single voter to the rolls. And they have contacted none of these voter victims to register them. And would you believe this? When I posted the list of the purged, and it's at GregPalast.com, when I posted a list of the people who had been purged by their Republican predecessors with a link to help these voters re-register, the two white women told me to take it down because they said telling voters they're purged will discourage them from voting. Excuse me? If a voter's registration is canceled, they can't vote. Now, that's very discouraging. Now, please don't feel offended by my mention of the race of the officials in Michigan. The truth is, I found that as a general rule, when it comes to blocking voters to voter suppression, the official's party is somewhat meaningless. Their race, however, is crucial, as shown in the different response to my work by Wisconsin and the African-American lieutenant governor, and Michigan. Remember, as you just heard from my book, the Michigan Democrats refused to count the uncounted ballots in Detroit in 2016. Now, is this Democrats' fear of a black party? I don't know. I'm just a reporter, not a psychologist. By the way, if you'd like a free copy of the entire audiobook, How Trump Stole 2020, my foundation is subsidizing free downloads this week of the entire book. Just go to GregPalast.com, write in audiobook. So, GregPalast.com for a free download of the entire audiobook, How Trump Stole 2020, Unabridged. And by the way, I want to thank you for tuning into this Pacifica station. This is information you won't find anywhere else. I don't know if your station is in Fund Drive, whether they are or not. Cough up the money, because you won't miss your water till your well runs dry, and you won't miss the news until it's outlawed. This is Greg Palast, happily reporting for Pacifica Radio.
The most expensive Senate race in U.S. history is taking place in the state of North Carolina. It's also a battleground state in the presidential race. Davine Dial from Pacifica affiliate WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina, has this report.
This is WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina, and I'm Davine Dial, reporting on North Carolina election activity. North Carolina has voted Republican all but one of the last four presidential elections, and it could be decided by which communities come out to vote in greater numbers. Republican-leaning rural voters who tend to be white, or urban areas where professional and black voters could tip the balance to Biden. Trump won North Carolina 50-46 4 years ago. The state has gone Republican in every presidential election since 1968, with the exception of Barack Obama in 2008 and Jimmy Carter back in 1976. Latest polls in North Carolina show Trump neck and neck, with Trump at 48 and Biden at 49%. And early voting is very strong in North Carolina, with 2,697,901 votes as of October 23rd. North Carolina has especially been on the radar due to the Tom Tillis-Cal Cunningham race.
Cal has said anything he could to get elected.
Seriously, this is a person who time and time again shifts his positions, writes and rewrites his record.
If Tillis loses, it's highly likely the Senate will flip. And this is partly why there has been so much attention to North Carolina. In what many analysts are saying is a major factor for the Senate, Tom Tillis is in a dead heat with Cal Cunningham.
I think that we are seeing and experiencing an unprecedented failure of leadership in this country.
In a crisis, you don't go for perfect. You go for good steps in the right direction.
Cunningham leads Tillis by only 2 points, with Cunningham garnering 49% and Tillis garnering 47% of likely voters. Recent sexting revelations on Cunningham have not hurt his chances, according to Nate Silver's 538. On the whole, Cunningham's odds haven't budged because the polls haven't shifted. The difference between the two candidates in the survey falls between the 4.5% margin of error, but Cunningham has accumulated more than double Tillis in donations. The latest FEC reports show Tillis with almost 20 million raised, but Cal Cunningham at $42,784,795. That concludes our report on the two major races in North Carolina. This is WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina, signing off.
This is Pacifica Radio's COVID Race and Democracy. We'll be back in a minute. This is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. An alarming number of tenants fear losing their housing because of the COVID-19 pandemic lockdown. Attorney, organizer, and Pacifica WBAI radio producer Mimi Rosenberg explains how this is happening in New York.
We already have population of at least 92,000 people who are homeless, 54,000 who are homeless families. The other are generally singles who are in the congregate shelter system or in temporary hotels and motels and the like. So we are in a city where its predominant form of revenue comes from the real estate industry. And that has everything to do with the policies and practices that have inured to, before the pandemic, the growth and reality and stimulation of homelessness. And what I mean by that is it has to be understood, but it is, of course, the Trumps of the world, but it is the government that sets the policies and acts as the handmaidens for the Trumps of the world who are realtors and made their money essentially such as it is from realty. The fact is that it is the gentrification process that set in motion the removal of people from their homes and their neighborhoods to bring in a wealthier base, the rest of the public housing units who are impoverished. And it's a slippery slope to losing all of that housing when you've done that. They've taken the community centers. They've taken the public space there, what limited parks or playgrounds they have, and similarly sought to build housing there. So there's also a policy of destruction of public housing, which we've managed to, and that is with a very active and thoughtful tenants movement. We've stemmed the tide, but we've lost considerable numbers of units in public housing. And again, that is the housing of last resort. And it's not only the housing of last resort for poor people, but it's a good housing stock that has been allowed to deteriorate and making it rife for schemes to try and demolish it, replace it with luxury units, etc. So we're losing our public housing stock, and with it the population, of course. And we have the largest public housing stock and the best in the country. The policies that inure to what has become a major homeless population emanate from the Democrats. It has to be said that where COVID fits into this is, of course, the disparities are abundant of who has been most subject to contracting the contagion of COVID-19, and that is the Black and brown and immigrant populations. Overwhelming numbers of people that have been affected are certainly peoples of color. And that's understandable because of their living circumstances. One, they are the low-wage workers that are in the most essential jobs, from the transit jobs to the grocers to the postal workers, etc. And most of the janitorial staff and others in the healthcare profession. And they are certainly the people, because of their low income and poverty, have been subject to the greatest number of health problems, from diabetes and high blood pressure, etc., which has made them much more susceptible.
That was attorney Mimi Rosenberg, co-host of Building Bridges on Pacifica's New York City station, WBAI. And now, a few words from comedian George Carlin on houselessness.
Listen, I got a couple ideas for homelessness. First thing we ought to do, give the homeless their own magazine. Give them their own magazine. You know what you call it? Better Crates and Cartons. Then when they get finished reading it, they can use it to line their clothing. Well, that's the kind of answer you'd get from a conservative American businessman. He'd say, yeah, let them read it, and when they get finished reading it, they can use it to plug up the holes in them piano crates they live in. A good, practical, sound American business conservative solution. I'll give you an idea about homelessness. First thing you got to do is change the name. It's not homelessness. It's houselessness. These people need houses. A home is an abstract idea, has to do with a setting, a state of mind. These people need physical, tangible structures. low-cost housing. But where are you going to put it? Nobody wants you to build low-cost housing near their house. They don't want it near them. People say, not in my backyard. They don't want it near them, especially if it might help somebody else. It's part of the great American spirit of generosity. You can ask the American Indians all about the great American spirit of generosity. If you need current information, try a black family. They'll help you figure out the great American generous spirit. These days, we call it 1,000 points of light. Well, I got an idea where we can put some low-cost housing. Golf courses. This is just what we need. Golf courses. Plenty of good land. Plenty of good land and nice neighborhoods, land that's devoted now to a meaningless, mindless activity engaged in primarily by white, well-to-do male businessmen who use the game to make deals to get together to carve the country up a little finer among themselves. Golf is an arrogant, elitist game, and it takes up entirely too much room in this country. Entirely too much room. Listen to me. You know how much room it takes up? 17,000 golf courses, about 150 acres each. That's 3 million acres. That's 4,800 square miles. Two Rhode Islands and a Delaware you could build for the homeless on the land that's currently devoted to this meaningless, mindless, arrogant, elitist, racist game. Racist game. Racist game. I say it's time to reclaim that valuable land from the wealthy and turn it over to the homeless. You see, I have solutions. You know the only problem? No one ever calls. Rarely get a call from Congress or a think tank.
That was comedian George Carlin on houselessness and golf courses. Golf courses are also controversial because of their use of pesticides and large quantities of water. The New York Post recently published a story on Hunter Biden, the son of Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden. The story alleged, as has been alleged before, that Hunter used the family name to make money overseas. The Post's work was heavily criticized and censored by most media outlets and by Facebook and Twitter, but not by pushback, journalist Aaron Mate's show on the Gray Zone website. Mate spoke to Ray McGovern, a longtime CIA analyst whose former job was in part to provide briefings to the President of the United States. Here's part of their conversation.
The New York Post recently published a series of articles based on a trove of leaked emails purportedly from the laptop of Hunter Biden, the son of Joe Biden. These emails appear to show more evidence of Hunter Biden cashing in on his proximity to his father, Joe Biden, while Joe Biden was vice president. But the reaction to this story from the Post's media colleagues was quite different than normal. Instead of reporting on the story and evaluating the emails on their merits, news media outlets and former intelligence officials immediately declared them as disinformation. Twitter and Facebook even prevented people from sharing the New York Post articles on their platforms. And then came a round of declarations that the emails were in fact the product of Russia.
And to me, this is just classic textbook Soviet-Russian tradecraft at work.
Even this, you know, campaign disinformation period is as dangerous to our democracy as anything exposed in these emails.
Ray McGovern, a former longtime CIA officer, let me start by asking you your response to this letter signed by former officials, including John Brennan of the CIA and Jim Clapper, the former head of the National Intelligence Office, claiming that they believe that this Hunter Biden story has, quote, all the classic earmarks of a Russian information operation.
Well, if you look at the first name on that list, it's Jim Clapper. Now, I want to tell you, Jim Clapper is the quintessential Russian analyst. He allowed himself to say in late May of 2017, he told Chuck Todd, he said, and I quote,
I will tell you that my dashboard warning light was clearly on, and I think that was the case with all of us in the intelligence community, very concerned about the nature of these approaches to the Russians. If you put that in context with everything else we knew the Russians were doing to interfere with the election, and just the historical practices of the Russians, who typically almost genetically driven to co-opt, penetrate, gain favor, whatever, which is a typical Russian typical Russian technique. So we were concerned.
Okay. One of the commentators said, you know, this is xenophobic and racist, for God's sake. A whole people are genetically driven to be to deceive, to co-opt, to penetrate and gain favor. Oh, come on. So this is James Clapper. Now, you have to forgive him because he grew up in the Air Force and became a general there, and he subscribed to the old ethos of General Curtis LeMay, who spent his life trying to obliterate the Russians, or at least to bomb them to smithereens. So that's who is beside all this. Now, this has a history, Aaron. I mean, how did a guy like this get to be then the director of national intelligence? Now, as a matter of fact, when he lied before Congress under oath with respect to whether NSA was monitoring all our emails and telephone calls, et cetera, and said no, and then was proven wrong when Ed Snowden came out and said yes, he apologized to Congress by saying, yeah, what I said was clearly deceiving or clearly wrong, okay? Now, what happened?
I believe his term was, I said the least untruthful thing I could say. That's how he tried to explain his lie. He said it was the least untruthful thing I could say.
Yeah. Well, that's what he said to the press. What he said in a formal letter to Congress was that it was clearly erroneous. So he was allowed to stay in that position for just a little while, like 3.5 years. And then Obama put him in charge of this incredibly stupid intelligence community assessment, which said that Putin ordered the hacking of the DNC emails. Now, there's another example of what we're up against here, of the testimony of the head of CrowdStrike, the cyber firm that James Comey, in his wisdom, deferred to and said, now you do the forensics on that terrible hack that John McCain is calling an act of war by Russia. You do the forensics and tell us what you think. Well, they never gave Comey a final report, and they prattle this legend that the Russians hacked the DNC. But when the head of CrowdStrike was forced to testify under oath, the date was December 5, 2017, Adam Schiff, the chair of the committee at the time, House Intelligence Committee, said, Mr. Henry, tell us, do you know exactly when the Russians hacked into the DNC? And Henry said, oh, yeah. Oh, then his lawyer pulled his head. And Henry said, well, actually, we don't have any evidence.
This is very important to stress, Ray. So Sean Henry goes in December 2017. We only got his testimony recently, kept under wraps for almost 3 years. But he is asked by Adam Schiff, quote, do you know the date in which the Russians exfiltrated the data from the DNC? And let me read to you Sean Henry's immediate answer. I do. I have to just think about it. I don't know. I mean, it's in our report that I think the committee has. And then Schiff says, and to the best of your recollection, when would that have been? So this is not in the transcript, but obviously at that point then, Henry's attorneys, who was there with him, leaned over and said something, because then in the transcript, Henry says, counsel just reminded me that as it relates to the DNC, we have indicators that data was exfiltrated. We do not have concrete evidence that data was exfiltrated from the DNC, but we have indicators that it was exfiltrated.
That was on the 7th of December, 2017. So they did keep that secret for a long time. Finally, the new acting director of national intelligence told Adam Schiff, the head of the committee, look, either you release that testimony or I'm going to do it. Mm-hmm. And it was only on May 7th this year, 2020. that was released May 7th. Do the arithmetic. I think that's more than 5 months. Have you seen it in the New York Times? Have you seen it in Washington? So, you know, there's a lesson here, right? The mainstream media can suppress this thing. And fast forward to today, they're suppressing the hell out of the Joe Biden or Hunter Biden email hard drive stuff because they don't want anything like that before the election. There's been a lot of lying in Congress. A lot of Congress know what's going on, too. And they don't have, I have to say, hate to say this, they don't have the courage to move against the national security state any more than the administration does.
That was former CIA analyst and co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, Ray McGovern, talking to Aaron Maté on Pushback, a show on the Gray Zone website, grayzone.com.
Y viene remontando el Amazonas, el grito rebelde del Carioca, y viene a unirse con su hermano, el obrero venezolano. América Latina obrera, América Latina obrera, América Latina. Levanten tus manos la bandera de la revolución, América Latina obrera, y griten con fuerza, Yankee Go Home. Yankee Go Home, Yankee Go Home.
That was Venezuelan singer and songwriter Ali Primera with Latino America Obrera. Undermining elections, empowering violent right-wing extremists, enriching oligarchs, installing fascist governments. All pages from the U.S. imperial playbook for decades. From Merida, Venezuela, Venezuela analysis editor Ricardo Vaz explains aspects of the upcoming Venezuelan National Assembly elections with Pacifica's Ken Yale. President Nicolas Maduro was elected 2 years ago, and assembly members will be elected this year. Juan Guaido, the president of the National Assembly, whom the United States tried to promote as Venezuela's legitimate president, even though he had never even run for president, is not running for assembly again. This election takes place in the context of economic hardship caused by U.S. sanctions, U.S. seizure of Venezuela's substantial oil infrastructure in the U.S., and the Bank of London's seizure of its gold reserves.
Venezuela is having elections for the National Assembly in December. This is a virtually unknown lawmaker, Juan Guaido, decided on U.S. instructions to proclaim himself the interim president. This was on January 23, 2019. They expected a quick victory, so they expected perhaps the army to turn against the government and stage a coup, or that there was going to be a popular uprising that was going to back this opposition and topple the government. Guaido's enthusiasm and momentum very quickly dissipated. But because the U.S. was so invested in this idea that he was going to overthrow the government, they decided from a very early stage that they were going to boycott these elections. So since their horse is not in the race, the U.S. has resorted to its traditional tactic of saying that, you know, ahead of time, the election is going to be fraudulent, they're not going to recognize it.
Let's just make a couple of quick connections here to the United States. I mean, first is the obvious blatant hypocrisy of 4 years of nonstop Russiagate narratives about foreign interference in U.S. elections, while the U.S. has been interfering in elections in Venezuela and around the world on a daily basis.
Yeah, I mean, the double standard is obvious. Lots of analysts have pointed out that Venezuelan elections were always held with the gun to the head. So it was inevitable that all these dirty tricks of trying to delegitimize elections elsewhere and not recognizing results were eventually going to be used in the U.S. The U.S. election system is very Byzantine in many respects and has very, very many weaknesses that can be exploited for fraudulent purposes. In Venezuela, that's very different. In over 20 elections, there have always been claims of fraud, but there has never been any actual credible evidence. Because of the way the Venezuelan electoral system is built, people go into the voting center, they present their ID, and they have a touch screen, and they select which party and which candidate they want to vote for. they confirm, and a paper ballot is printed, and they should confirm if that matches the choice they just made in the computer. They deposit this paper receipt in the box. They sign an electoral registry, and they leave. And then at the end of the day, once all the voting centers are finished, 54% of all the voting centers are chosen at random. The electronic totals are matched against these paper ballots that were deposited in a box, and they have to match, of course. And the 54% chosen at random basically assures that whatever result comes out is irreversible from a statistical standpoint. And this is just what's done on election day. Before, there are lots of checks and audits, and after as well. So it's a very hard system to break. And that's why we've always seen these claims of fraud even ahead of time, because there isn't any evidence after the election. So why bother, right? You can just say it ahead of time and you have an uncritical media apparatus that's going to echo whatever you say.
Let's step back a little bit and paint some more of the context. Venezuela has been in a process of grassroots transformation for decades that its supporters call the Bolivarian Revolution. And what is that?
There's a movement that starts in the Venezuelan army in the 1980s. This is a period of very difficult economic crisis with kind of hardcore neoliberalism being implemented. And there's a group of officials, chief among them, Hugo Chavez, who tried to rescue these past ideas of Bolivarianism. Chavez gradually built an alternative and he won the elections in 1998. The 2002 coup attempt forced Chavez to understand that this was a very deep struggle, a class struggle, and that he needed to move in the direction of socialism. So Chavez proclaimed that the Bolivarian Revolution had an anti-imperialist character. So then the Bolivarian Revolution tried many different forms of popular organization. This idea that democracy needs to be organized from the grassroots is one of the founding principles of Chavez's movement. The communal councils were going to be the basic cell of local government, which later was upgraded to the commune. And so the commune, in Chavez's words, is the space from where we're going to give birth to socialism. And because of the economic crisis, which is so severe, and you can see it in all aspects of day-to-day life, there has been a kind of a dangerous return of old ways of doing politics. You know, there's a higher intolerance to criticism. There's a bit more of a tendency to do kind of top-down organizing instead of relying and trusting people to organize their own popular democracy. The material conditions are very hard. People spend a lot of time just trying to sort out their basic needs. There have been lots of setbacks in this popular organization that was very vibrant, and we're hoping that it can have a resurgence at some point.
In the United States, when people talk about democracy, the first thing that comes up in the dominant narrative is you have a right to vote. But this is a very different concept of what democracy means under the Bolivarian Revolution. What does that really mean, popular democracy and the conception of the Bolivarian Revolution?
The most advanced point of the project of building socialism, the idea that communes were really going to be the government in the territory, and in the end gradually replace the old liberal democratic state or bourgeois state. This was going to be a local government that has an assembly, which is the supreme power, where people really have the power to decide on the issues that affect their daily lives. It's going to be responsible for electricity, water, garbage collection. It's going to be able to design its own education programs. It's going to be able to produce and plan according to the community's needs and not just, you know, based on making a profit. I mean, there are still votes, you know, people vote at all levels, but not just to decide, you know, who sits at the top, but really to settle all their issues.
Why has the United States been trying to destroy the Bolivarian Revolution since its inception?
It's the idea that it's a bad example, right? This quote-unquote virus that could spread to other parts and really undermine U.S. hegemony in the continent. This model worked, and it gave the Venezuelan people their best living conditions in memory. And so there was this very effervescent time in which a popular organization was spreading throughout the whole country, and the economic crisis arrives in 2014. U.S. sanctions escalate to a really murderous level, especially from 2017, and that has really hurt efforts to organize from the grassroots and to really build these kind of alternatives. We can present the issue the other way around. I mean, you have a severe economic crisis. For example, salaries are very devalued at the moment. How is it that the people have not turned against the government, right? In any other place, no government would survive an economy in which GDP has contracted by 50%. And of course, there are many people who are unhappy with the government and no one can blame them. But there's also a very significant core that remembers the unprecedented standard of living that they had under Chavez, and the majority of the country, which had been, as happens in any other capitalist country, right? And they were neglected and they weren't political actors. And then all of a sudden they became in charge of their own destiny. And that's not something that they are very easily going to give up on.
So let's talk a little bit about the future. What are you seeing? And then what message would you have for people in the U.S. who care about social justice?
I think opposition to sanctions has to be the priority for social movements and solidarity movements in the United States. You know, this is really something that's unacceptable, something that's illegal. And most of all, it's something that's causing a lot of pain and a lot of suffering and a lot of death in Venezuela and in all of the countries that are suffering under U.S. sanctions. Even beyond sanctions, the war drums sounded very loudly. In the middle of this year, there were these wild and unfounded, quote-unquote, narco-terrorism charges against the Venezuelan government. And that was used as an excuse to unleash the largest military deployment in the Caribbean since the 1989 invasion of Panama. So this was really the U.S. empire flexing and showing its teeth right on Venezuela's border. Keep an eye on Venezuela in these final few weeks of the campaign, and then afterwards, as we build up to the elections, see what kind of tricks the U.S. might have up its sleeve to try and change the outcome or try and stop the election from taking place altogether. Keep a critical perspective and not just believe what the mainstream media is going to say, because it's a very biased narrative.
And just to open your mind to the possibilities of how life could be different, not to romanticize it, but just to see a people in the process of questioning and developing and building their own power and considering alternatives. And that's, as you mentioned earlier, I think that's a very big part of what the threat is, that model and that process with all its contradictions, trying to undertake a social transformation and economic transformation, political transformation is inspiring and something that people really should see if they have the opportunity.
It's not like there's a recipe here in Venezuela. Sometimes the media would present Chavismo as this kind of monolithic, uncritical, almost zombie-like religious cult following Hugo Chavez, when the reality is much different. These are very critical people who became politically empowered with the Bolivarian Revolution. And it's a very dynamic movement with its internal contradictions, as you were saying before. And in this time of crisis, where the direction that the government has taken, especially on economic policy, has come under question, there are lots of debates, you know, see what other things people have been trying, how they've been successful, where they failed, what kind of obstacles they faced. All of this is something that's useful to understand what's the route to building a different model, a different society.
And that was Pacifica's Ken Yale, speaking to Venezuela Analysis editor Ricardo Vaz. Venezuela Analysis is an independent website produced by a team of international journalists that provides perspectives from grassroots and left movements in Venezuela. And finally, my own editorial about the kidnapping of real-life Hotel Rwanda hero Paul Rusesabagina. This first aired on WPFW Washington, D.C.'s Voices with Vision. Paul Rusesabagina, the real-life protagonist whose heroic story is the basis of the film Hotel Rwanda, is now imprisoned and on trial in Rwanda for preposterous terrorism charges.
So 20 years later, we see that all of those people who advocate for human rights, for our rights, the political rights, all of those who advocate for media freedom, all of those who advocate, who speak for the voiceless, are put in prison.
Rwandan operatives kidnapped him in Dubai at the beginning of September and forcibly extradited him to Rwanda on the orders of Rwandan President Paul Kagame, who has for years been celebrated as Rwanda's savior, the general who stopped the genocide. A long list of investigative works, most recently Judy Weaver's book, In Praise of Blood, Crimes of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, and decades of UN reports detailing the Rwandan army's atrocities in both Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo have belied that tale, but U.S. and other NATO nations continue to support Kagame. Paul Rusesabagina is a longtime critic of Kagame's regime and its war on the Congolese people and the Rwandan refugee population who crossed the Rwandan-Congolese border to escape his advancing army in 1994. I've spoken to him for Pacifica's KPFA radio and the San Francisco Baby newspaper about Rwanda and Congo, and for Counterpunch on invoking Rwanda to attack Syria. I read and recommend his beautiful book, An Ordinary Man, and I've followed his activism on behalf of peace in the African Great Lakes region for over 10 years. I hope to see him released.
20 years later, there is another sad story of many innocent people who have been killed. I remember in 1994-95, I was in Rwanda. I witnessed a displaced camp being destroyed by machine guns on the ground and helicopter bombardment in the air. We have witnessed what has been going on in the neighboring Congo since 1996, because a group of people, especially from Rwanda, attacked this country, the Rwandan New Army, because of minerals. And they, since then to date, we have had more than 7 million victims, more than 300,000 Rwandan refugees from the Hutu side have been killed, all of them because of what they are, because they were Hutus. And this has been documented by the UN mapping report. 20 years later, many proxy militias have been entertained in my neighboring Congo.
All that said, I first reacted negatively to Hotel Rwanda, the Hollywood movie based on Rusesabagina's heroism in protecting more than 1,000 people who took shelter in the hotel he managed during the 100 days of massacres that began on April 6, 1994. I reacted negatively because the story was already being used as propaganda for U.S. wars. Paul Rusesabagina himself has said that he was happy with the movie as the story of a man taking a moral stand amidst a bloodbath and collapse of social order. But the movie is at the same time a simplification with a Hollywood ending. Unfortunately, that simplification has been used to try to justify the destruction of the Libyan state in 2011 and the relentless bombing of Syria that began in response to a false flag chemical weapons attack in 2013. In both cases, the U.S. claimed that it was compelled to stop genocide, as it had failed to do in Rwanda, even though Bill Clinton's administration actually stepped in to prevent a UN intervention during the Rwandan genocide, because they wanted to see then-general, now-president Paul Kagame win the four-year civil war that preceded the final 100 days of massacres. They wanted to see him seize power and become their partner in the region. But the misuse of the movie is no reason not to campaign for the release of Paul Rusesabagina, a true champion of human rights. Virginia Senator Tim Kaine, ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee on Africa and Global Health Policy, published a letter to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo urging him to demand a fair trial for Paul. The George and Amal Clooney Foundation and the American Bar Association Center for Human Rights have said they're sending an observer to make sure he gets a fair trial. However, no one who knows much about Rwanda could imagine that a fair trial is possible. And even if it were, his kidnapping and rendition to Rwanda broke international law, including the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which both the U.S. and Rwanda have signed. It also violated his constitutional rights as a permanent resident of the U.S., and the U.S. needs to demand that he be returned. And if Rwanda wants to extradite and try him in Rwanda, they need to go into court in the U.S. and make their case to do it legally. There's more on this in my several reports on Paul Rusesabagina's situation in Black Agenda Report, including my interview with University of Pittsburgh Law Professor Dan Kovalik about legal and political possibilities for getting him back to the U.S. As he said, you can't just go around kidnapping people. Paul Rusesabagina, and not Paul Kagame, is among Rwanda's real heroes. He's also a hero to the Congolese for speaking out against Kagame's catastrophic war and occupation of Congo, which has cost millions of black lives.
I think the only better future for Rwanda and the region would be to silence guns at once, to silence guns and give a chance to words. By dialogue, we then find a lasting peace. That is the only way to a lasting peace.
That concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by Polina Vasiliev and myself, Van Garrison. The show's executive producers are Akua Holt, Steve Seltzer, and Polina Vasiliev. Verna Avery Brown is our executive consultant. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Thanks for listening.